Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI pronounces his annual State of the World address. Some of the ambassadors present for the Pope's discourse share their first impressions. Hear a first-hand account of Philippa Hitchens' travels in the Holy Land. And film critic Peter Malone tells us what he likes about The Iron Lady. Pope Benedict XVI on Monday expressed his deep concern for what he called a profound disquiet that is darkening the world at this moment in time. Speaking during his annual State of the World address to the members of the diplomatic corps accredited to the Vatican, Pope Benedict's wide-ranging discourse did not fail to shine the light on issues of concern right across the globe. As per tradition at the beginning of the year, Pope Benedict on Monday morning received some 115 ambassadors to the Holy See in the Vatican's Sala Regia, the regal room.
Excellence, Mesdames, Messieurs.
The occasion was his much-awaited State of the World address, in which he tackles issues of international concern and consigns his message into the hands of world leaders. He commenced by addressing the grave and disturbing developments of the global economic and financial crisis, which, he said, not only has affected families and businesses, but has created feelings of disorientation and frustration, especially in the young. The crisis, the Pope continued, can and must be an incentive to reflect on human existence and on the importance of its ethical dimension.
La crise peut.
Benedict then turned his attention to North Africa and the Middle East, where, speaking of the Arab Spring, he invited the international community to dialogue with the actors in the current processes and to contribute to the building of stable and reconciled societies that are opposed to every form of unjust discrimination. And the Pope voiced his concern for the people of Syria. He encouraged Iraqi leaders to advance on the path to national reconciliation, and he turned his attention to the Holy Land, where tensions between Palestinians and Israelis continue to affect the stability of the entire Middle East.
La communauté internationale de son côté doit
Then the Pope turned his attention to the pivotal role played by young people in society and underlined the need for solid educational institutions and policies which promote the family and aid social cohesion and dialogue. In this perspective, Pope Benedict continued, it is clear that an effective educational program also calls for respect for religious freedom, which he described as the first of human rights. And Benedict went on to highlight the fact that in many countries, Christians are deprived of fundamental rights, sidelined from public life, and even violently attacked and forced to leave their homes. In the past year, he said, religiously motivated terrorism has reaped numerous victims, especially in Asia and Africa. Before ending, Pope Benedict mentioned continuing good relations between the Holy See and the state of Italy. He spoke of the need for African leaders to favour progress along the path of justice, peace and reconciliation, and of the humanitarian emergency in the Horn of Africa. And the Pope did not neglect to mention his concern for continuing violence and instability in Nigeria, in Ivory Coast and in the Great Lakes region, and he appealed to the international community to make every effort to find a solution to the crisis in Somalia, which he said has gone on for years. Last but not least, Pope Benedict highlighted the need to foster respect for creation and stressed his belief that environmental protection and the connection between fighting poverty and fighting climate change are important areas for the promotion of human development. One diplomat present in the Vatican this morning for the Pope's address was the British ambassador to the Holy See, Nigel Baker, who told me of his impressions immediately after the audience with the Pope. Of course, you were there this morning in the Sala Regia, a very sombre discourse, actually, I read it. What struck you the most?
Yeah, well, I think sombre reflection of the world situation, but not gloomy or pessimistic, I think, for me, is the important tone. And for me, the overall message was, don't let short-term crises deter you from the important long-term policy goals and objectives. And His Holiness was very clear that we should not despair at this moment of crisis, but we need to look forward with new commitments, new dialogue, renewed dialogue, new creativity for ourselves and for the younger generations. And he flagged up several very specific areas, including looking at the Middle East, including looking at Europe and European crises, including looking at the importance of strengthening religious freedom around the world, flagging up the problems, but looking forward to a future and urging creativity and greater leadership from world leaders.
Considering your own, let's say, geopolitical area, which themes touched you the most?
First of all, the thing that struck me is absolutely imbued throughout this speech was that reminder of the global role of the Holy See. You know, this is why, you know, one of the principal reasons why the United Kingdom engages across a whole range of issues with the Holy See is because we both ourselves and the Holy See have a global outlook. And so the Pope's message covered global issues and all of the regions in the world, from accords with countries like Azerbaijan and Montenegro to relations with the United Nations and the International Migration Organization, to his visits to Africa and to Europe, and of course concerns in the Middle East. So I think that for me was a key aspect and confirms our engagement with the Holy See across this wide range of issues. Clearly, looking at Europe in particular, the focus very much on the economic crisis and the need to look at this crisis beyond just economic terms. I thought it was very, very important, you know, that it's, you know, coming out of the crisis all about education, it's about the young, it's about looking at aspects of the ethical dimension to the crisis, our spirituality in its broadest sense, not just about economics. And I think also, you know, what he's saying about aspects of religious freedoms, that, you know, there has been progress, including in Europe in some of these areas. He flagged up Georgia, where there have been progress, and also the role of the European Court of Human Rights in aspects of religious freedoms. And a big priority issue for the United Kingdom, and I was very pleased to see His Holiness flag this up as one of his important messages, the whole question of the environment, the important Convention on Climate Change conference concluded in Durban, and the need to look forward to and prepare for the big Rio Plus 20 conference in a creative and committed way, because sustainable development, looking towards the future, the Millennium Development Goals, where they go, and the future of the planet depend on us working together on these. So it was great to see the Holy Father focusing on these areas.
Finally, Ambassador Baker, taking his discourse today as a starting point, but looking ahead to this year to come, what hopes do you have for some possible solutions ahead?
For the United Kingdom, there are a number of areas of particular focus which converge very much with those of the Holy Father. Somalia is something that he focused on very much, and the United Kingdom will be leading international efforts in the year ahead, starting at a major conference in February, to unite the international community and find solutions to this sort of ongoing problem of the instability and violence and divisions in Somalia. Clearly, the Middle East, where I think, you know, we need new beginnings in Syria, we need consolidation in Egypt and Libya, we need stabilization in Yemen and the Iraq, focusing on the young people, their democratic hopes for the future, and the Rio Plus 20 conference, which is going to be a great priority for ourselves. So areas that absolutely dovetail with the Pope's message. I think we also have, as far as Britain is concerned, you know, other areas of priority. Burma, where our Secretary of State has just been, great focus on human rights there and the way forward. Afghanistan, of course, the development of reform, rule of law. All of these areas are going to take up a lot of time in my own government. And I know that the Holy See has great concern. I think I also like to flag up a positive area, despite this rather gloomy outlook. As I said, pleased that the Holy Father is looking at the positive aspects of the way forward as well. And in the United Kingdom, of course, this is the year of the Olympics and Her Majesty the Queen's Diamond Jubilee. So we will be looking forward finding solutions to grave economic and political problems in the world, also looking for positive messages for society and looking to celebrate a little as well this year.
But can I ask you one last thing? You are a new ambassador here in the Vatican, so I presume this is your first at this very special audience that's held every year at the beginning of the year. What did it feel like?
I think it's an important occasion for the diplomatic corps. It's, of course, we're in magnificent surroundings, where I think one gets a sense of the permanence of the Holy See to which we are accredited, and the Pope's message really emphasised the global engagement, as did the fact that many of my colleagues around the room, not just resident ambassadors but non-resident ambassadors as well, from all corners of the world, were there to listen to what the Holy Father had to say. So it's a solemn moment. It's an important moment in the life of the diplomatic corps here. And great privilege to be there and to be part of it. And I hope very much that the United Kingdom can pick up on a lot of the messages that the Holy Father gave to us today and develop them as we work with the Holy See. So a great occasion to attend and an important one in the life of all the diplomats accredited here.
Ambassador Tim Fisher from Australia, meanwhile, told Emma McCarthy that the Pope's return to the theme of education is the issue that struck him the most.
It was a very solid and sober presentation by the Holy Father, and I particularly took up on his return to the theme of education, education for young people, education as part of religious freedom and cultural progress in the Middle East and around the world. And having just returned from Bethlehem University, where 1,000 Christian, 2,000 Muslim students all worked together on the same campus, I thought the theme was just very commendable.
Ambassador Fisher, your outlook now for 2012, picking up on what the Holy Father had to say, and indeed in your own concerns as the representative for the Australian government here.
It was, as I said, a sober message from the Pope at the start of the year, because it is a very sobering world, a circumstance in Syria, which he referred to, and many other places of great trouble. But equally, the arrival of South Sudan as a new nation state was highlighted by the Pope, and we wish, and Australia wishes to build its relationships with countries, new countries like South Sudan, as we continue to expand our links right around the world.
In the next couple of days, we will be featuring interviews with some of the other ambassadors to the Holy See present at Pope Benedict's State of the World Address on Monday morning. And of course, it's all on our website. A group of bishops from Europe and North America are currently travelling in the Holy Land as part of a 5-day annual pilgrimage to support Christian communities in the area. My friend and colleague Philippa Hitchin is travelling in the Holy Land with the bishops, and she's also had the chance to get around and speak to people who are involved in development, aid, education and so on. On one such occasion, Philippa visited St. Martha's House in Bethlehem, the first dedicated daycare centre for elderly ladies in the city. Much of the original development and the ongoing running costs are provided by the charitable organisation Friends of the Holy Land, with contributions from the Katinian Pilgrimage Group. Mrs. Laila Asfura is the founder and director of St. Martha's House. Proudly, she shows Philippa a photograph album and told her that since the opening of the house last May, the house has received many visitors.
We have many visitors, as you can see. In the middle is His Grace, the Archbishop of Westminster, Archbishop Vincent Nicol, and all the women here celebrating his birthday when he visited us. It happened that he came on the 7th of November, and his birthday is on the 8th of November. So we've celebrated the occasion here. He was very happy with that. And we have here also the Archbishop Patrick Kelly of Liverpool, who visited us with a small group. The Governor of Bethlehem is on the other side, the upper one. He also visited us. Friends of the Holy Land here, the Papal Knights group as well came last May and they visited us. Another group from England, parish pilgrimage. So we have here the Grand Magisterians members, Grand Magisterian member, Dr. Michael Willen again, and Mrs. Siemens. And here are our, the ladies, part of them, the upper one, mm-hmm. right side hand, these are the ladies.
You were saying you have how many people here, roughly?
We have 35 at the moment, yes. They come twice per group. As you can see, the premise is not so big, so we cannot take all of them on one shot. So we divided them in two groups, Monday, Wednesday, and Tuesday, Thursday.
But you have quite a lot of room here for the activities. Tell us a little bit about what they do when they come here.
First of all, we pick them up with the minibus that we thank God for and thankful for our donors that contributed in the price, in the cost of the minibus. They pray when they arrive. They pray. They get something to drink, light breakfast, you know, depends on what we have. Afterwards, they start their entertainment. For example, they play card, they play bingo. They talk about their stories, previous life, experience in their life, which is we are at the moment actually collecting all these information and producing a small booklet.
Which you will publish to try and hand on to the next generation.
Sure, we hope so. We hope so, yeah. Yeah, yeah. It will be first on Arabic and then we will translate it to different languages. We'll see.
What kind of stories do these women tell? These are all elderly women, aren't they? Over 70 or so?
That's right. They are all, most of them over 70 to 92. The age reaches under to 92. The stories actually about, they tell about their experience in their lives. For example, how they've got to know their husbands. How they've got their children, what experience they have, they would like to pass on to the new generation. And stories that might people keep talking about in the future.
You said some of these stories are very sad stories. Can you perhaps share something that's particularly touched you?
True, actually, because as you know, the political situation here in our area has been always an issue. And these ladies experienced the Turkish era, the British era, some of them the Turkish and others from the British era and now with the Israeli. So they have suffered lots throughout their life. And how they managed to survive, there are many, many sad stories, actually, because they've been starving in different time of their lives, how they managed to look after their children, how they help their spouses or husbands. You can feel that the Palestinian had never an easy life. Or you can even tell that we've never had a very easy life comparing to the lives of others all over the world. It's true there are many problems, but it's not the same as we had.
It's an important moment for them, isn't it, to be able to tell their stories?
Yeah, yeah, this is absolutely. This is why we are here. Actually, this is our main objective, to gather these ladies and to help them in many different ways. It's not just physically providing services. It is also a psychological part of it. Or let me say, it's most of it, it's psychological help or providing support, love, care, that not to keep them feeling neglected, because actually financial-wise they are vulnerable ladies. They are poor families and they don't have much to entertain themselves or to look after themselves, so this is why we are here.
It must be quite a touching moment for you too. Tell us how you first got the inspiration to start up this centre.
Actually, the idea came out because of the personal experience that I live. My mother, thanks God, still alive. She's living. She has now 90 years old, 92 even. And I come from a big family. Everybody goes out looking for his job. So she left behind with nobody looking after her. So I thought, why don't think of establishing a small daycare center for the ladies, the elderly ladies, and gather them together, provide some services, whatever we could. And it's not just my mother, it's my neighbor, my friend, my mother-in-law, for example, my aunt, members of our society. So, and with the Lord's help, it happened. We are now established, we have our house. And actually, I would say I trust, and with faith, with lots of faith, that the Lord's wanted to happen.
Vatican Radio's film critic Peter Malone talks about a film that is apparently not going down very well in England, but that is almost certain to receive at least a couple of Oscar nominations. The film in question is The Iron Lady, and it focuses on Margaret Thatcher, with a real tour de force by actress Meryl Streep. Let's talk about Meryl Streep. I actually went and had a look at some excerpts from real documentaries from the life of Margaret Thatcher, just to remember exactly what she was like. And then I watched the trailer for this film and I was extremely impressed.
Oh, yes. It's a tour de force. Not that we didn't know that Meryl Streep could do such things. When you think of the range of performances over... well, 30 years now, it's over 30 years since she won an Oscar for Kramer versus Kramer, and almost 30 years since Sophie's Choice. But I gather she, of all actresses, has received the most nominations for Best Performance by an Actress. And here she is again at the at the top of her career. She really is Margaret Thatcher.
Mrs. Thatcher, one simply has to make you look and sound like the leader that you could be.
No matter how. But I had a great difficulty because I'm not a fan of Margaret Thatcher, and, you know, what do you do when there's a film about somebody that you didn't really like? Can you be very objective as you watch it? But whatever the performance and the strength of the screenplay, you are actually caught up in it, even disliking her, but understanding why you dislike her. So, again, well-written and well-performed.
Well, maybe it even has historical value in the sense it really is a cut on a very definitive period of British and European history.
Someone must say the unsayable.
Methinks the lady doth screech too much!
It is, and the interesting thing about the film, if they were able to give two Oscars, I think Meryl Streep deserves them both, because for the bulk of the film, she's Margaret Thatcher, you know, during her politics and political career.
Watch your thoughts, so they become words. Watch your words, so they become actions. Watch your actions, so they become your character. Watch your character, for it becomes your destiny.
And it is my duty.
Ambition that's got me in this. Our ambition. And the rest of us, me, the children, we can all go to hell.
But for a lot of the film, she is in her old age, pottering around her house in London, becoming very forgetful, imagining that Dennis, her husband, is with her and conversing with him, which puzzles those who are actually trying to look after her, and her daughter Carol coming to visit her. So, in fact, we've got this continual movement between the two performances that Meryl Streep is giving, plus flashbacks to a younger actress who shows us Margaret Roberts, as she was when she grew up, in Grantham in Yorkshire, and in a very Methodist, conservative politics family, very much influenced by her father.
I will never be one of those women who stay silent on the arm of her husband. One's life must matter, Dennis.
That's why I want to marry you, my dear.
So it's a very rounded portrait of Margaret Thatcher, really.
And it also touches on a couple of very important moments of history. I see here the Falklands War.
The Falkland Islands belong to Britain, and I want them back.
The time leading up to the European Union, her contacts with Ronald Reagan. There's a lot of politics in the film, isn't there?
Yes, you get the background of her defiance, really, against the men in the Tory party in wanting to stand for Finchley in London, then her winning and the way that they treated her, and then her decision to run as for leader of the Tory party, not expecting to win, but at least to be there, so that it builds up to her election as Prime Minister and then shows the hostility of the miners, her very harsh treatment of people, and that utter conviction that she had, you know, that the principles she espoused were right.
She heads a most hated government this country has known. This is the best you can do. I had better do your job as well as
everyone else's.
Best be careful not to test one's colleagues' loyalty too far.
But I found I wasn't really sympathetic, of course, but once you saw the scenes of the Falkland War and her motivations and her decisions for that, and then later, especially when she becomes bullying to her own cabinet, there's a terrific scene of the cabinet meeting where she humiliates her colleagues and doesn't realise this, and you realise she's preparing her own downfall.
Our party and our country need a new leader.
The rules make it possible to depose a sitting Prime Minister.
So, yes, the politics come alive very vividly.
Your comment is very appropriate, very interesting, I think. You say the film helps us appreciate Margaret Thatcher, whether we like her or not, whether we approve of her or not. So it's a clear picture of who this really remarkable woman was, isn't it?
It is. I had a mischievous thought that I have enjoyed some films about Genghis Khan, so therefore I should enjoy a film about Margaret Thatcher. A bit mean-minded to say, but you see the point I'm making. But I realised, and a friend of mine wrote in a review here in Melbourne the other day, he said that the film does the extraordinary thing of eliciting some sympathy for a woman who was fairly pitiless in her behaviour towards others. So I thought, yes, it's doing something like that. And I think most people will be amazed at the performance and I think drawn in by all the politics. Although I'd have to tell you, I was sitting near a young reviewer the other day and somebody said to him, you know, did you like The Iron Lady? He said, oh, it was forgettable. And I thought, oh dear, probably too young.
Well, I'm certainly very interested to go and see it. I was pretty young during those years, but I do remember them. I'm very interested in history, so this film certainly does appeal to me.
Yes, I think most people who go to see it will be very satisfied by it, the writing and the performances.
And inspired by the fact that she comments that every day was a battle for her.
Oh yes, and Meryl Streep says that with all the force that Margaret Thatcher would have said it originally.
With all due respect, sir, I have done battle every single day of my life.
You're listening to Vatican Radio's English programme. Laudetur Jesus Christus.